Gamley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Lots of people have interesting careers, but perhaps few as unique as that of our guest today. We're talking with Ben Killam, a resident of the Upper Valley and a professional bear rehabilitator. For 20 years, Killam has worked with New Hampshire Fish and Game, caring for cubs whose mothers either died or abandoned them. He takes them into his home, nurses them until they're strong enough to live outside in an enclosed yard, and then eventually Killam brings them into the forest and teaches these cubs how to live in the wild again. Working so closely with bears and observing them over countless hours, Killam has also become one of the country's leading experts on Ursus americanus, or black bears. His firsthand research has led to new understandings about these creatures, including their system of communication based on an amazing sense of smell. While most people know that bears have great noses, Killam discovered their snouts are so finely tuned that one way bears converse is to open their mouths and smell each other's breath. Now Ben Killam has put this and many other observations and discoveries from his many years among the bears into a new book. It's called Out on a Limb, and he joins us today. Let's hear from you too, Exchange listeners. If you've had encounters with bears, what did you notice? What, if anything, surprised you? Also, just what basic questions do you have about New Hampshire's black bears? How they live? What happens when they interact with humans? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment or a picture of a bear on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Ben Killam, welcome back. It's really good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, and I wanted to, before we get into all the really cool research that you have in this book, Ben, just step back a little bit. You've worked with bears for so long. What sorts of preconceived notions do you think, Ben, that a lot of folks have about bears when they don't know them as well as you do?
Well, bears go back in our history a long way, and the reality is they're in our genome. We have a fear of spiders, snakes, bears, and sharks, and if anything that those animals do make news. I mean, it's national news. If you want your 15 minutes of fame, have an interaction with a black bear that's a little bit negative. And this goes way back in our history. There's a German historian who wrote a book about bears and history in Europe, and he found evidence of a brown bear being buried next to a human with a stone pillar in between them from 80,000 years ago. The pagans, our European ancestors, revered the bear as the king of beasts. They thought it was highly intelligent, a fierce fighter, and they revered it on every level. And it wasn't until the church, the organized church, came along that bears were demonized. And the church saw the bear as a competitor and reduced its rank to vermin, replaced it with a lion as the king of beasts. And we have came to this country with a bias against bears. The first thing we did was kill all the bears.
Wow. So we're sort of hardwired for a while to be afraid of bears.
We were hardwired. I mean, you hear stories about Davy Crockett killing, 104 bears, and that's what we did. And the Native Americans, the bears were highly revered. They were a source when they did have to take them as a source of fat or fur. It was a very sacred occasion, and they would usually take them at their dens. They wouldn't say anything. They wouldn't brag about the experience, and they were highly revered. So, the bears have a long way to go to reach the level of status that they should reach.
And that cultural reverence that we used to have for them back in the days of the Native Americans and pagans in Britain and so forth.
That's right. We've been biased by other humans. We've had our minds altered, and what I've been doing, and I've simply followed the evidence, and I found these bears to be extraordinary animals. They fit at every level the kind of reverence they had with Native Americans and early Europeans.
Let's talk about a couple of the other ideas that people have about black bears. And you talk about this in the book, Ben. First of all, talking about them being ferocious. You know, you said if you want your 15 minutes of fame, have an encounter with a bear. Let's just get this straight. We're talking about New Hampshire's black bears, Ursus americanus. We are absolutely not talking about grizzly bears out west, which is a whole different species with a more aggressive personality.
Well, the black bears, because they live in the forest, can retreat. They can hide behind a single bush. Their black coloration is a background color, and they literally disappear. And they have no desire to encounter us. They have no interest in humans. They have interest in other bears. And the few encounters that have taken place have been minor, when people have tried to interfere with a scrap between their dog and a bear, which is never a good idea. The last human death in New Hampshire by a black bear was in 1780.
That was the last time a human was killed by a black bear.
And in modern times, bears, because of the social behavior that I've found in them, that a social behavior that parallels early human behavior, they're reciprocal altruists. Bears share food naturally, and they think highly of those who share food with them. So the bears that we have here today are getting bird feed from our bird feeders, and they come into your yard, and if there's no aggression, there's no sign that they're not welcome, they see that you as a friend. And bears get friendly quicker than any other animal out there. And when they get friendly, they're considered nuisance bears.
Yeah. We often hear about that.
And then we punish them for that.
But again, the bear we're talking about is not that ferocious, scary polar bear or the grizzly bear. Ursus americanus, the black bears here in New Hampshire, are really mostly interested in running away from you.
They are interested in running away from you. But I would counter you and say that from my experience, the ferocious grizzly bear and the ferocious polar bear are not as ferocious as people think either. I have a friend who's a Russian researcher. He's the deputy researcher for Wrangell Island. He goes up there and stays in a little cabin where the walrus congregate, and there's 140 polar bears that come in around him. He goes out and walks among them.
Really?
And films them.
Polar bears?
Polar bears. And he said, he when he first went out there, he said, I can't stay in this cabin all winter. He says, I've got to go out and... So he decided to be a dominant polar bear, and he understood how their actions and communications, and they let him walk around. He didn't have any trouble with them at all. And
by the way, those bears are huge, bears.
They're huge, and they're meat eaters, but they primarily seals and blubber, and they don't see humans as food. And so he's not had any negative problems dealing with it. He set an imaginary perimeter around this cabin. It's literally a tiny cabin. And if a polar bear crossed that line, he'd go out with a stick, and he'd just stomp the stick on the ground, and the bears would turn and go away.
Being the alpha bear.
Well, they recognize territory. So even here in New Hampshire, a bear coming into your yard knows that it's your territory. He comes in tiptoeing. He's looking for some sign that he's not welcome. And, of course, we're locked in our house, looking out through our sliding glass door windows and taking pictures. If you stepped out on the porch and looked at that bear and took one step towards it, he'd dust. He'd be gone. And that's how easy it is to manage him. But most people don't dare step out of the house.
Well, speaking of pictures, Ben, if anyone listening today has snapped any great bear photos in your neighborhood or in your backyard while out on a hike, you can email them to us at exchange@nhpr.org. Just include your name, where the photo was taken, and we'll post them to our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And I hope after this show, Ben, we have a great little gallery of people's photos of bears. Again, it's NHPR Exchange. That's our Facebook page. You can join us now with a question or comment for Ben Killam. We're talking about the inner life of bears. And Ben's just released book called Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Again, Ben Killam is the guest. He's worked with New Hampshire's Black Bears for 20 years. Join us with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We want your stories about your encounters with black bears, or just your basic questions about them. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Ben, in the introduction, I mentioned that among the many things that you do, you are a professional bear rehabilitator. Wow. I mean, how do you do that? How do you rehabilitate a cub whose mother has died or has abandoned that cub? Where do you even start?
Well, I started with the first set of cubs that I had, and my interest was in their behavior. At that time, it was thought that cubs at the age of 5 months could be released into the wild and they'd survive. Well, they do survive right up until winter, and then they can't put enough fat on and they don't survive the winter. And so I wanted to know what it was about these cubs that the mother needed 18 months in order to raise them.
When she kicks them out of the den, 18 months.
That's when they leave. And they're developmentally ready to leave, and you know they've traveled with her for those 18 months. So I wanted to know what it was that they needed for that. And the first cubs that I got were very young cubs. They were abandoned by their mother. They were about 7 weeks old. And they had no experience with her outside the den, so they had no influence from their natural mother. These were bottle-fed cubs. These were already habituated to me. So I took advantage of that, and I walked them loose in the forest. And I gave them an opportunity to learn their natural environment and respond to it. And at the same time, I got the opportunity to see how they responded to it, and that was huge. And I learned that they could instinctively find food and identify food. I discovered an organ in their nose, which I coined the Killam organ, that allowed them to hold a leaf in their mouth and determine whether it was edible or not.
Wow, before they bite it and
before
possibly
they
be
bit
poisoned.
It or possibly be poisoned. And this is something that the Native Americans gave credit to the bear for identifying plants that could be used for foods and pharmaceuticals. And here I found the organ that allowed that to happen.
Wow, congratulations, by the way.
And they also use the same organ for olfactory communication, airborne scent. They can recognize another bear and react emotionally to it, i.e. they know who the other bear is. And so they're just a fascinating animal.
Yeah, and I want to, after a short break, we'll start going to our listeners, but also ask you just a little bit more about that interim step, Ben, between nursing a little teeny cub and letting it go. There's a lot of cool stuff that happens in between there. So we'll talk after a short break, and we'll take your calls. So join us at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Kerry Johnson, NHPR's justice correspondent, is coming to New Hampshire. NHPR's Laura Kanoy and Johnson will be discussing the intersection of justice and journalism at the UNH School of Law, a joint project with the Warren B. Rudman Center. Join us this evening at 5:30. You can reserve your free ticket right now at nhpr.org. This event sponsored in part by the Couch Family Foundation. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Froling Energy, providing and installing high-efficiency wood pellet boilers for commercial, institutional, and residential space heating, online at frolingenergy.com. From AARP, offering educational sessions and communities statewide on the new health insurance marketplace and what it means for you and your family, information at healthlawanswers.org. And the Spine Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, using research results to build customized treatment plans, information at dhspine.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're finding out more about the inner life of black bears. In his just-released book called Out on a Limb, New Hampshire's Ben Killam describes what he's learned in 20 years researching, studying, observing these animals. He's found out that they have an elaborate social structure, complex communication, and behaviors that, he says, at times look a lot like ours. We're finding out more this hour, and let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 877. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, if you've taken any Great Bear photos in your backyard or out in the woods, you can email them to us at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll put them on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Ben, before we go to our listeners, just a little bit more, if we could, about what it takes to rehabilitate a bear, because I think it's fascinating. So, you know, these first cubs that you rehabilitated, you said they were really young, 7 weeks old. You bottle fed them. But then there was kind of an interim phase, right, Ben, where you went outside, but you kept them in the yard.
Yeah, the first cubs, I didn't have any real facilities. I had a cage in the woods, and basically they could get out of it. They knew how to undo locks.
Oh, they found a way to get out of it, really?
Yeah, I had to put even multiple locks. It was enough to delay them so I could get to my truck and get out of there. But,
really? They figured out a way to undo multiple locks?
Yeah, they can see what we're doing. Their insight is huge. I mean, it's seen in their nuisance behavior. If bears smell food, they get it. I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of contraption you set up trying to keep them away from it. They're that smart. But with the cubs, there are multiple types of cubs that come to me. There's the bottle feeders, the very young cubs, and then there's the abandonment cubs. First-time moms often abandon their cubs when they run out of milk. They didn't put on enough fat. And these cubs are very gracious for the fact that we picked them up. They'll come up and explore my face and give me a kiss on the lips, stick their tongue between my lips. And they want to be taken care of. And then there are the cubs that come to us from bad circumstances. The mother gets run over. Mother gets shot at a chicken coop. Traumatic circumstances. These are cubs that usually come in June when the mother starts to travel with the cubs. And these cubs are completely traumatized, and they settle down and they realize that we're taking care of them. I now have a decent facility. I have an 8-acre forested enclosure, which has ponds and oak trees and pine trees and wetlands, and it has all the components that they need to learn how to live in the wild. And I found that it's not only important that they know how to eat, but they need to be able to socialize with other bears. And that's where the forested enclosure works. They're able to have skirmishes. There's wild bears that come up on the outside. There's puffs of scent from wild bears. So they have that mother experience. And it also saves our time, because if we had to walk every cub, it's hugely time-consuming.
So how do you eventually let it go, Ben? I mean, at that age of 18 months, I think is what you said earlier, right? How do you, you know, I hate to put it this way, but say to the bear, okay, you need to go. You're a big boy or girl now, and you need to go.
Well, the initial cubs that I worked with, I explored all that, and I found that when the time came, they went.
So it's instinctive.
It's instinctive, and it's like, human children, you know, at 18 years, they start, you know, to want to go and do other things. Some of them stick around till 28 years, but these cubs, they're ready to go by the time they're 18 months old. And they would go out and they would make friends with other bears, wild females and the like. And I was able to catch them at those activities. And they learned very quickly from their wild counterparts when they encountered them.
So when you have let them go, so to speak, you write in the book that some of them come back to visit, right? I mean, especially Squirty.
Well, Squirty was one of the early cubs. She's now 18 years old, and we'll have her 10th set of cubs this winter. But most of the cubs now are transported and hard released in different parts of the state, mostly in the northern part of the state.
I see. So you don't release them near your home in the Upper Valley.
They're not being released near my home.
And is that confusing for them?
It's not confusing. We've tracked these bears. We had a UNH graduate student did a study on 11 of the cubs over a two-year period. In a good food year, they stayed right where they were, close to where they were released, stayed up eating acorns. It was followed by a bad food year, and they dispersed, and many of them were lost in the hunting season. One of them traveled as far as Sherbrooke, Canada, from the release site. And so they don't stay where you put them. They've got to find their own place in the bear world.
I have to ask you this, Ben, and I know you've been asked probably 100 times. Is there a danger that your bears, if I could put it that way, are too comfortable with humans and that that's dangerous for them?
That's not the case. And the reality is bears want to be bears, dogs want to be dogs, and humans want to be humans. And it's only humans that think all animals want to be like us. And they really have no interest in humans. And the reality is that the bears that get fed at bird feeders and on garbage around people's houses, those bears get tamer than any of the bears that I raise. We use a single caregiver system. My sister and I do all the caregiving. And they don't know strangers. And bears recognize even other bears as strangers. So,
although Squirty has stuck around.
Squirty has stuck around, and she was able to create her own home range and share that with daughters and granddaughters, and she's been successful. She's figured out how to live through hunting seasons, and I've been very fortunate that she's survived as long as she has.
In a couple minutes, Ben, I want to ask you about the difference between male and female bears, because there's a lot about that in the book, too, and a lot of your observations are about female bears. So in a minute or two, I'll ask you about that. But right now, I want to share you with our audience. The number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Ben Killam is with us on his new book, Out on a Limb, taking your questions and comments about New Hampshire's black bears and your stories, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Christopher's up first from Kittery. Hi, Christopher, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Ben. Great show. just a little story. I used to live up in Sunday River in Bethel, Maine. And my former wife and I were sitting out on the porch one night with the floodlights and overlooking a lake with little copse of wood. The next thing we looked, and it's one of these magic moments, here comes a black bear with its two cubs ambling through just outside the copse. And she turned around and saw us and, you know, had a good look and realized that, you know, we're no threat, we're just sitting there watching. And the next thing, one of the two cubs, I don't know what it did, but Mum kind of turned round, and the next thing, the little cub right up a tree. And it was just one of these magic moments, and it's hanging on, looking down at Mom, and she's staring up at it. And the next thing is, she kind of sat there looking at it, and then she's kind of ambled off with the other cub, but kept looking back. And the next thing, the other cub comes slowly down the tree, very, very like, you know, Mom's not happy with me. Oh, you know. And it was just, we were like, oh my goodness. We never had a camera, unfortunately, there. But it was just one of these, like, you know, you can't buy that kind of experience.
No.
And it was fabulous looking. And they were so clear right there. And the little cub is looking really sheepish, you know, and Mum's like waiting for it. You know, you better catch up here, otherwise I'm going to chase you again. And it was just wonderful, wonderful experience. They're such beautiful animals. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, Ben, was what is the normal size of a litter?
That's a good question. Thanks a lot for the story, Christopher, and for the question. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, the normal litters in New Hampshire are 1 to 3 cubs. There are some litters that go as high as 4 or 5 cubs, and I've had one report from Minnesota of a female with 7 cubs. But generally speaking, on natural food supplies, 3 cubs are about the limit of what will survive. The cubs the mothers that raise 4 and 5 cubs all are being fed by somebody.
You know, he mentioned the mom and the cubs, and we have heard don't go near a mom who's got cubs. Especially, I've heard that about grizzlies, that a grizzly will leave you alone, but heaven forbid she's got a cub. What about black bears? What if Christopher, our caller, approached that tree where that bear, that little bear, was up in it?
Well, you know, the reality is that the myths about mothers and cubs just don't bear out.
Really?
My friend Steve Herrero, who wrote the book on bear attacks, has collected the largest database on black bear-human interactions, negative interactions, and death. And there have been 67 human deaths by black bear in the last 100 years. And of those, 84% were caused by large adult males. 3% were caused by females with cubs. And so the statistics just don't saddle up to it. And in that case, if he had gone out and tried to approach the cub, he probably would have been false charred. She probably would have lunged at him, expelled a big blast of air, letting him know that he's broken her rules, that he's infringing on her space.
A false charge, though.
Yeah.
She wouldn't go all the way through with it.
No, this is intentional communication to communicate to him based on the context of the situation that what he did was wrong.
Back off.
If he tried to. And you know, we see it as the bear's going to eat me.
Yeah.
but it's just not the case.
Well, and this is a dumb question, but I'm going to ask anyway, because all those fairy tales have bears roaring. Do bears roar? They don't, do they? If they were sort of making a false charge, they wouldn't.
They very rarely roar. If two males are in a contest over a female, you'll hear roaring. If they're really angry at each other and having that kind of contest. But the most of their communication is not roaring. But it is intentional. It's as intentional as our language.
So what kind of noises do they make?
Well, the female, that when she wants to rally her cubs or lead her cubs away from a tree, makes a gulp vocalization, which is if they're angry with each other and they're expressing that, there'll be a guttural sound from their lungs. And if they're walking away and want to let the other bear know that they're not weak by walking away, that they're, you know, they want to let the other bear know that they still have status, it'll be a huff. But the meaning of each of these is based on the context of the situation. So a mother bear will even use some syntax with her cubs. If she wants them to tree, she'll gulp walking towards the tree. She wants them to come down. She'll stand up and look at them and then gulp walking away from the tree. And so it's that mixture of body language and the direction that she's walking and the gulp vocalization that bring the cubs in line and make them do what they want to do.
Christopher, thanks a lot for the call. Great story. The number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And up next is Kelly in Rumney. Hi, Kelly, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I was just listening to him talking about the bear communication, and we live on the edge of a state forest with a bog and a beautiful natural area. We see bears occasionally, but what we hear in the summer when our windows are open are these screams that almost sound like a woman screaming. And we've been told that that's a bear. And I was wondering, is it true that they make that noise, and why do they do it?
If it is true that they make it, right? It could be another creature entirely. Yeah,
right.
What do you think, Ben? Thanks a lot, Kelly.
Well, it's definitely not a black bear. And
they don't scream.
They don't scream. But some of the wildest screams out there are porcupines when they fight. And they just make incredible sounds. I had to go to one of my neighbor's house who said he had a bear in the tree and he was making unusual noises. And I went there and I said, that's a porcupine. We took a flashlight and looked up into the tree and there was a porcupine. But there are even raccoons make awful noises when they're fighting with each other. So there's a lot of sounds in the night. If you don't go investigate them, you're not going to know what they are.
Kelly, thanks a lot for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Also, if you've taken any great pictures of bears in your neighborhood or when you're out in the woods, email them to us at exchange at nhpr.org. Give us your name, where the photo was taken, and we'll post them on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page right now, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email is exchange at nhpr.org. A couple emails just came in, Ben. I'd love to share these with you. This is from Betsy. She says, she's in Enfield, New Hampshire. She says, because of Ben's book, Among the Bears, this is your earlier book, we are no longer afraid to just walk in the woods. Of course, we won't ever try to make friends with them and we honor their space, but we don't fear them as we did before. So we thank him very much for making the woods a friendly place for us. Betsy, that's great. I'm wondering if you've gotten that kind of comment before, Ben.
I get a lot of that kind of comment. I mean, I spoke in Vancouver, British Columbia one time and West Vancouver, and there was a line of 10 people after my lecture, and they came up and thanked me because they could now go outside their house.
Well, and they could have before, but they didn't realize
it. They just didn't understand the bears. They just thought they'd be eaten.
Here's another email. This person, Julie, says, after several mornings of finding our bird feeders, I'm sure you get this all the time, bent to the ground and out, and our suet feeders gone, even the one 10-foot up swinging on a rope, we're now bringing in the feeders every night. Julie from Ringe says, when do the bears finally hibernate so that we can safely leave our feeders out? Julie, I'm sure this is a question that a lot of folks have.
Well, generally it's safe after Thanksgiving, but that's not to say that all the bears necessarily hibernate that early. In good food years and mild winters, which we're going to have more of with climate change, male bears will often stay out all winter long as they can access food. I've had reports of bears at bird feeders in January, March. And so it depends on the circumstances. If we have a hard and heavy winter and they don't have access to food, they all go to den. Almost half of the female bears that I track right now have already gone to den. The females go first because they're going to give birth to cubs or they have cubs. The males go last because their strategy is to get big enough in order to mate.
If it's a warm winter, do they hibernate as long as they would, 30, 40, 50 years ago?
Well, the females do.
Because I wonder about climate change and its impact on their habits. Go ahead.
The females do, but again, the males, their strategy is to get big, and if they have access to food, they're going to get up and take advantage of it.
So to answer Julie's question, they could be out there for a while.
And the reality is, if they're still coming, stop feeding. And it's not even safe to bring your bird feeders in at night if the bears are coming around, because they know where that food comes from.
You know, you write, Ben, that male and female bears have very different lives. And, obviously one is raising cubs and the other is not. But give us a little bit more, if you could, please, because most of your observations have been about female bears.
Yeah, the female bear, needs a high-quality range in order to raise her cubs, and she can't have that competition from the males because the resources are scattered and spread.
Competition for food.
And so she generally lets the males know that they're not welcome. If there's a surplus of food, they have a strategy to come in and overpower her so they can have access to her surplus. And they generally form loose groups of friends that come in and overpower the females. So they always have access to food. Males generally show up where there is a surplus of food. But males are fairly transitory. If you put a radio collar on a male bear and he disappears over the mountain, you're going to spend all summer in an automobile or an airplane trying to find him, and you're not going to get very much information.
And the female's not going to go that far?
The female's home range is generally 3 to 15 square miles, and she's going to be in it year in and year out. She's your bear. She's your resident female.
Wow. All right. More of your questions and comments after a short break. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. More with Ben Killam after a short break.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, surging Medicaid enrollment and tough questions about the launch of healthcare.gov. Then a special Halloween reader's review of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Exeter Hospital's Center for Breast Health, offering comprehensive and caring breast health services, encouraging regular clinical exams and mammograms online at exeterhospital.com. And White Mountain Oil and Propane in North Conway, providing installation of heat and glow gas logs, fireplaces, gas stoves, and hearth products online at whitemountainoil.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Carrie Johnson, NPR's justice correspondent, is with us. You can email your comments and questions for Carrie Johnson before the show at exchange@nhpr.org or comment on Facebook at NHPR Exchange and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that. Today in The Exchange, author Ben Killam is with us on his brand new book. It's called Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Ben Killam has been studying New Hampshire's black bears for 20 years. His book tells about what he's learned about these creatures. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions about black bears or your encounters with them. 1-800-892-6477. And Ben, before we go back to our listeners, I wanted to return to this idea of bears and how they communicate. And we've touched on it, but there's a little bit more that I want to get at with you. Your book explains, finally, why we see pictures of bears with their mouths wide open. Most people look at that and they say, you know, wow, look at those ferocious creatures. They're in a fight. They're roaring at each other. And you say, no, they're actually talking. What's going on there?
Well, some of the pictures that are out there are trained bears.
Really?
Trained to open their mouths, because bears don't open their mouths very often. But they do have some communication. They come together to solicit sharing of food with open mouth gestures, and they will be exchanging breath. I've seen this, filmed it at night, so it's clearly not just a visual thing. It's one about breath. So if there's a small amount of food and two bears come together and they want to share it, they will communicate in this manner. bears greet each other nose to nose. They kiss and check and exchange breath. They don't take anything for granted. So I see a lot of that kind of behavior. But basically, with communication with bears, has, like our language, has an emotional aspect, which is honest communication, as well as an intentional aspect, which is mechanically generated sounds and action. So our language is an emotional utterance with a mechanical manipulation of our lips, teeth, tongue, and larynx. So we lie with our words, but if you read our expression on our faces or our body language, you can tell if we're telling the truth or not. Bears have facial expression. They have the intensity of their communication, which is emotion. And they have, unlike other animals, scientists believe most animals only communicate with emotion. They cry out and others hear them. But bears on a regular basis communicate and cooperate with strangers, and that's much more dangerous than dealing with family members. So they have to be able to lie or bluff, and a bear's false charge or its chomping of teeth or its that guttural vocalization, the swatting, all of that are intentional communication. They're rationally communicating with you based on the context of the situation. They're telling you to back off. Take false charging as an example. If you meet a female bear on a trail, her cubs are already up a tree, she may false charge you, which is rushing at you and expelling a big blast of air. She wants to delay confrontation long enough for communication to take place. She was just out there having a nice day when you came along, and so were you. So there's no reason for confrontation. But if you're working at a restaurant and you're carrying a pail of food scraps out to a dumpster and a bear false charges you, he simply wants you to drop the pail of food scraps. And I was with Squirty one afternoon up on Lambert Ridge in Lyme, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and this thunderhead came rumbling up the valley, and Squirty false charged the thunderhead. And believe it or not, the thunderhead turned and left, and the sun came back out.
No, come on.
Yeah, it did.
So those, they may be a bluff, but it's a convincing
but
one.
But again, it's based on circumstance. So you've got to read it as how, you know, you look at the situation, and then what are they saying to me? What did I do to cause this? But it, if they're false charging, if they're chomping, if they're swatting, they're doing any of those things, that's a good sign.
All right, Ben, lots of people want to jump in our conversation, and you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. By the way, earlier I asked folks to email us their pictures of bears at exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll post them on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Be sure to include your name and where the photo was taken. Lots of those pictures have come in, so I think we'll have some great things to look at a little bit later. Let's take another call if we could. This is Rob in Dunbarton, and go ahead, Rob, you're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about, you spoke about the climate change, and with the milder winters, I know that the tick population has really exploded. I know I can't walk in my woods anymore with so many ticks, and I also know that it's affected the moose population. I was wondering if it's threatening the bear population as well, with so many ticks out there.
Yeah, it's a great question, Rob. And we did a show a couple weeks back, I'm not sure if you caught it, about the intense stresses on our moose population now. Thank you very much for the question. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, it does not seem to be affecting the bear population, although bears get ticks and they don't like them. They're able to groom them off, and they're often just a big scab afterward. But they also get the deer tick, and they're probably getting some Lyme disease. There's not much record other than the fact that there is some evidence of it, of how it affects bears. But other than being, you know, a general nuisance, there doesn't appear to be any detrimental effect of black bears.
Yeah, well, it's a good question and one that I had as well. So thank you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's some basic questions that just came in from Pam in Guilford. And Pam, thank you. She says, when are bears born and what is the average size of a newborn? She's got a couple others too, but how about that, Ben?
Bears are born in the dead of winter, generally mid-January. They weigh less than a pound. Their eyes are shut. Their little ear flaps are down. I guess that's about the...
How much food does a bear eat, Pam wants to know. Big difference probably between males and females there.
Well, the average bear during the summer is eating 5,000 to 8,000 calories a day.
Wow, that's a lot.
Well, as they prepare for winter, they go into a hyperphagia, and that number, because the average bear needs to put on 30% of its body weight in fat to get through the winter, and the average female that's going to give birth to cubs needs to put on 50% of her body weight. So during that period of hyperphagia, which is generally late August, early September, they can go up to 20,000 calories a day.
Wow, that's amazing. 20,000 calories a day. All right. And Pam's third question, she says, do black bears ever eat game? And if so, can they become rabid? Pam, thanks for the questions.
They're not true predators. They're opportunists. 85% of their diet is vegetative. Of the remaining 10 to 15% that's animal protein, 90 to 95% of that is ants, bees, and grubs. The remaining 5% of the 10 or 15% they will, on occasion, take deer fawns and moose calves in the first week of life. They'll take advantage of a bird's nest if they find it or a fledgling bird on a branch.
So they're not really hunters, but if they see something, if the opportunity presents itself.
They don't respond to movement or sound in the woods.
Yeah,
I've been out with fisher and fox and things like that, and every little sound that they're on top of. So they're definitely not a predator. And there was a second part to it.
No, that's it for Pam's questions. And Pam, thank you very much. And let's go next to Walpole. And Barbara's on the air. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I wondered if raising cubs by hand doesn't make them vulnerable to hunters. I read a marvelous book quite a while ago called something like The Bears and I, about a man who raised two cubs who became so accustomed to human beings that actually they were shot by hunters.
Yeah, Barbara, thanks for the question. We touched on that a little bit earlier, Ben, but go ahead. Thank you, Barbara.
I'm familiar with The Bears and I, and he raised them under human circumstances, you know, in houses, and didn't understand behavior and didn't try to acclimate them to their natural environment. What we're finding is that this year we released 30 cubs from the big surplus we had last year. Three have been taken in the hunting season out of 30. So, you know, the numbers don't bear out. But the cubs that we release are shot, and they're shot about proportionately to the wild population.
So not any more than the wild
not
population. They're not going up to the hunters and greeting them.
But none of them are going up to the hunters and greeting them. All these bears, when they get into the wild, they're influenced by other bears, and they react accordingly. They die more in poor food years, but so we, you know, last year, I think three out of four cubs that were released dispersed and ultimately were shot by hunters. But last year we shot 803 bears, the most bears ever taken in the state. So it is relative to food supplies and things like that. But this year, none of those 30 bears have been seen. They haven't been in anybody's backyard, and they haven't been approached. So.
The ones that you took care of.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you write, Ben, that bears have a lot of behaviors that kind of look like ours. You talked about communication and so forth. And later in the book, you really get into this a little bit more. You say bears represent what very early human society or culture may have been like. What do you mean?
Well, bears share food, and their access to the female home ranges are evenly dispersed on the landscape. Their food supply is the highest quality foods in the forest, the berries, nuts, and ants, bees, and grubs. These are generally available in patches that are unevenly dispersed on the landscape, and these are affected by frosts and things like that. So at any given time, one female bear can have a huge surplus of food in her home range, and her immediate neighbor can have nothing. And this leads to a system of sharing over time. And so Squirty is willing to give up her surplus to her neighbor under the condition that she has access to the neighbor's surplus when the tide switches.
So you've seen them share. Because our image of animals is, you know, it's every man for himself, so to speak.
Squirty shares her greater home range with her relatives, and every time she sees one of them, there's what I call a matrilinear hierarchy. She chases her relatives to establish the hierarchy. She lets unrelated females into her surplus and shows no aggression towards them whatsoever. And that parallels our behavior. We're much harder on our family members than we are on strangers. And the reason is that our family members are close cooperators, and we can communicate any way we want and make up. We can reconcile. But our strangers are also cooperators, and we don't go out and rank out a stranger the way we would a family member because we might not be able to reconcile. But they're still a valuable cooperator. And that same parallel takes place with black bears.
How do you avoid, in all this research that you've done and the writing and your thoughts that you just gave us about bears' social structures and how they reflect ours, how do you avoid anthropomorphizing? I mean, after all, these are still wild creatures. So do you ever find yourself crossing the line there?
I'm not anthropomorphizing when I talk about parallels because I'm making observations on behavior. All of this is written in a popular book. You know, you might say I am because I give Squirty a human name and things like that, but that's a bunch of hooey. You know, it's a matter of communicating. If I gave bear number 23 instead of Squirty, the reader's not going to be accepting that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's a matter of telling a story and getting the information across. I'm currently getting my PhD at Drexel University. All this stuff will be published in a form that will make everybody happy about, you know, putting it in a pure scientific sense. But I have the data, so...
When you talk about those family groups and how Squirty, you know, kind of arranged things, Ben, do those family groups ever include adult males, or once they leave the den, so to speak, they're kind of out of the picture? They're out ranging on their own.
Well, the females don't tolerate the adult males competing with her and her cubs until there is a huge surplus, and then they come in and share the surplus. But the adult males, you know, they're asked to leave, and they leave, which suggests there's a degree of female choice in mating, because without repercussion, they certainly wouldn't. They'd stay and compete. But it's the food supply is just not there in order for family groups to form. The traditionally social animal has a territory with a family group living within the territory, but all their resources that they need are there. They control that territory that controls all their resources. The bears are unable to dominate their own resources, so it has forced them to go into this sharing situation, which is it bears up to all the conditions that Robert Trivers laid out in his paper on reciprocal altruism, which he defined human behavior as. They have a judicial system. There's a delay between the act of sharing and the return. And in the case of the bears, it's over a year. I mean, it's a phenomenal delay. So it's not mutualism or some of these other types of social behavior.
You know, I have an email that is about another person's bear encounter, and this is Tom in Danbury. And Tom, thank you. He says, last spring we had a local bear mother with 3-year-old cubs. We also raised a few chickens. The bears took an unfortunate liking to chicken food and developed various methods of getting it. This reminds me of your story about the bears finding a way out of the yard that you created. Tom says this included actually entering the coop through the very small chicken door and bringing the feeder outside and ultimately into the woods to consume the feed. After some discussion with the State Wildlife Department, we installed a radio in the coop and set it to a talk station. This has kept the bears away from, I hope it wasn't this one, or maybe I do, has kept the bears away from the coop. Of course, the talk station we chose is NPR, and this has substantially raised the social awareness of the chickens. Tom and Danbury, you made my day. That is great. What do you think? I mean, having a talk radio in a chicken coop, it keeps the bears away. They think people are there?
Well, that's one approach, but the best approach is a baited electric fence. Electric fence where peanut butter or kitchen grease is spread on the top wire. Bears check out all new smells with their tongue. And once they get zapped on their tongue, they have no more interest in what's behind that fence. It's interesting that he brought up chicken coops, because chicken coops are the leading cause of orphan bears in New Hampshire.
Really?
Over the 30 cubs we had last year, half of them came as a result of people shooting mother bears at chicken coops.
Wow.
And this is completely preventable with means, whether it's a radio in the chicken coop but more preferably an electric fence with some bait or smell on it.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for the email. I hope your chickens are sustaining members here at NHPR. And I hope they enjoy this show. Ben, this has been really fun. And as I understand, the book is brand new, just out really officially November 1st.
It's just getting to the bookstores. Amazon's already shipping it. I hope people enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ben Killam again. He's a scientist, researcher, author. His new book is called Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. All during this hour, folks have been sending us their bear pictures. We'll put them up on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, so have a look there. We should have a nice gallery up in a little while. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. She's in the States speaking as part of our Justice and Journalism series, and for the last 3 years has covered issues ranging from voters' rights to the uproar over the National Security Agency's surveillance system. We'll talk about these and take your questions, so send us your comments for Carrie Johnson by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Fireplace Village, an alternative energy resource since 1972, featuring pellet gas and wood stoves with 4 locations across southern New Hampshire, online at fireplacevillage.net. And Hinckley Allen, attorneys at law who believe a lawyer should also understand your business. More information about Hinckley Allen and the clients they serve is online at hinckleyallen.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene,
90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is on Capitol Hill today. She's answering questions about problems would-be health insurance shoppers are experiencing on healthcare.gov. Yesterday, the head of the U.S. Centers for